VOA News, I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Donald Trump postpones tariffs on $250 billion in Chinese goods as a gesture of goodwill. Mr. Trump made the announcement late Wednesday in a tweet saying the Chinese vice premier asked for the delay in a time for the People's Republic of China's 70th anniversary on October 1st. The increase in tariffs from 25% to 30% was supposed to take effect on that date. They are now set for October 15th. There's been no response so far from Beijing. Mr. Trump's announcement came after China said earlier Wednesday it is exempting a handful of U.S. products from the next round of sanctions set to begin September 17th. They include shrimp, a cancer-fighting machine, industrial grease, and assorted chemicals. President Trump announced support for regulatory action against vaping amid hundreds of illnesses and at least six deaths. VOA Steve Herman reports.
President Donald Trump, while noting that the alternative to conventional cigarettes has become a multi-billion dollar business, said it is time to confront the health problems it is causing.
We can't allow people to get sick, and we can't have our youth be so affected.
Regulations are being created that would remove from the market most of the flavored pods for e-cigarettes that are attracting teenagers. The U.S. government, however, intends to allow tobacco flavors to remain as an alternative for conventional cigarette smokers. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
The Chinese woman arrested at U.S. President Trump's Florida resort has been found guilty of trespassing and lying to the Secret Service. Wei Jingcheng faces up to 6 years in prison when she's sentenced in late November. She showed no emotions as the verdict was read Wednesday at the end of a two-day trial. The 33-year-old was arrested at Trump's Mar-a-Lago private golf resort in Palm Beach back in March after approaching a Secret Service agent claiming she was a member of the club and wanted to go to the pool. This is VOA News. President Trump again dangled the possibility of easing U.S. sanctions on Iran if it can bring President Hassan Rouhani to the bargaining table. Mr. Trump told reporters at the White House Wednesday that we will see what happens. He added that the U.S. is not looking for regime change in Iran and said the country has tremendous potential. Scientists in China are reporting the first use of a gene editing tool to try to cure a patient's HIV infection. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
The 27-year-old patient has HIV and needed a stem cell transplant to treat cancer. Chinese scientists tried to create HIV resistance, which they have achieved in the past, by editing a gene in blood cells to mimic that mutation, using the CRISPR tool to cut DNA at a specific spot. It didn't cure the HIV, but genetics experts think that it does show promise for treating disease. A different researcher came under fire last year for altering embryos that led to the birth of twin girls. But experts say trying to cure one patient of disease doesn't present the same ethical challenges as altering DNA, which can affect future generations. I'm Jackie Quinn.
President Trump is set to visit the city of Baltimore in the state of Maryland. It is in the eastern U.S. It's a majority black city that he recently called a disgusting rat and rodent-infested mess where no human being would want to live. He'll be there Thursday to address Republican congressional leaders attending an annual retreat. Several protests are planned to coincide with his visit. Activist groups are planning to protest racism, white supremacy, war, bigotry, and climate change. That's according to the Baltimore Sun newspaper. OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma has a tentative deal with about half the states and thousands of local governments suing the drug maker. AP correspondent Tim McGuire.
The pending agreement is said to include additional money from the Sackler family, which owns Purdue Pharma. Sources say some $12 billion will be distributed over time, and the family will give up control of the company. About half the states and some 2,000 local governments involved in the litigation are on board, but some 10 other states are saying no. Connecticut Attorney General William Tong says in a statement that the scope of pain, death, and destruction, quote, that Purdue and the Sacklers have caused far exceeds anything that has been offered so far. The plaintiffs accused Purdue of aggressively selling OxyContin as a drug with low risk of addiction despite knowing it wasn't true. I'm Tim McGuire.
Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 12, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan's transition and government signed an agreement towards comprehensive peace.
We agreed to implement immediately the conflict-building measures by opening corridors for humanitarian purposes and for the cessation of hostilities and to release all prisoners of war.
Yasser Aman is deputy chair of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North. South Sudan president and rebel leader Riek Machar agreed to form a transitional government by mid-November. Kenya embarks on a one-week blood donation campaign, and former President Robert Mugabe's body returned home Wednesday amid uncertainty over his burial place.
It was received at the airport by President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who hailed him as an iconic leader, and he also said the light which led to independence is no more, but his ideology will continue to guide this nation.
That's reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe's service in Harare. And we'll discuss the mental health needs and hurdles to treatment in Liberia. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's transitional government on Wednesday signed an agreement with two rebel groups that could lead to comprehensive peace by the end of the year. The rebels include the Sudan Revolutionary Front, which is an alliance of Darfur rebel groups, and Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, which is active in South Kordofan and Blue Nile. Yasser Aman, the deputy chair of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, SPLM North, says the agreement calls for implementing confidence-building measures by opening corridors for humanitarian purposes, cessation of hostilities, and release of all prisoners of war, as well as the dropping of all charges against rebel leaders.
We have signed an agreement that is consisting of two parts. The first part is a conflict building measure that has been in the constitutional declaration, which was signed recently in Khartoum, and they formed the new government on the basis of that declaration. We agreed that to implement immediately the conflict building measure by opening corridors for humanitarian purposes and for the cessation of hostilities between the two parties to be monitored and to release all prisoners of war and to drop all the charges against the armed movement's leaders and so on. At the same time, also we agreed that we are going to start negotiations on the 14th of October and it should finish by 14th of December to put an end to the war.
So now that you have signed the agreement, what do you look forward to? Do you hope to share power with this current transitional government?
Well, first of all, we are hoping to address issues of millions of IDPs and refugees and to find a solution for the root causes of the war and for this war to be the last war in Sudan and to have a comprehensive, peaceful settlement and to have an inclusive process that will bring millions of people into the political process. They have been excluded, they have been discriminated against all these years, and to build an equal citizenship, a new socio-political, economical dispensation in the interests of the poor people in Sudan. That is the ultimate goal of this process. And we want to include the regional and the international community in this process to support it and to gain more momentum in this process.
Now that the agreement has been signed, will your forces allow access to some of the areas that were closed up?
Yeah, hopefully by signing this agreement, we will have a committee that will open the humanitarian access to the areas that has been closed for many years. What remains is the action to implement it. We are optimistic, but we are also cautiously optimistic.
Let's assume that you are willing to be in the transitional government. What role do you hope to play?
Well, the Sudan Revolutionary Front and other component of this agreement, they will play a role. I can't talk about my personal role. My personal role is to bring peace to our people, is to bring bread to them, clean water, is to address issues of women as marginalized in our country, to address issues of the youth, issues of the IDPs and refugees. Those are the central issues that we are looking for, and to have country and a power sharing that will accept diversity. Sudan is a country of war and discrimination, and it is a diverse country that needs to manage its diversity in the right direction.
Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much indeed, my brother.
Yasser Ahmad is deputy chair of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, the SPLM-NOF. He was speaking with us from the South Sudan capital, Juba. South Sudan President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar pledged to resolve all outstanding issues before the November deadline to form a unity government. As Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba, President Kiir and Machar emerged from Wednesday's three-hour-long meeting with all smiles.
As President Kiir and Riek Machar posted for cameras shaking hands, reporters called on both men to comment on their meeting.
The talks between us are going on well, and we will reach a deal soon. So let's be rest assured that things are going on well.
Machar noted that even though he is soon to be South Sudan's first vice president, once again, he is still not a free man.
Juba is home, and I have come back to Juba. Even if I go away for some time, the next coming, maybe IGAD will determine my status to be free to come and discuss more with you here. But our discussion here, we have made important progress.
Machar says he plans to hold a series of meetings with President Kiir in the coming days. Neither Kiir nor Machar would talk about whether they reached a consensus on unresolved issues like the number of states and their boundaries, or how they plan to canton, screen and train all government and opposition forces into one unified army before the November 12th deadline to form a transitional government of national unity. SPLM-IO Deputy Chairman Henry Odwar says today's talks focused on amending certain laws to come into compliance with the last year's revitalized peace agreement.
We talked on issues of constitutional amendment, the draft that is going to be presented to Parliament. And we also discussed about the few security laws. We also talked about the issue of non-signatory parties. As you are all aware, we have parties led by persons including Thomas Sirilo, Paul Malong. We touched on those and the need to bring them on board.
The peace deal mandates that the National Security Act, the Army Act, the National Police Service Act, and the Transitional Constitution be amended by Parliament before the parties form a unity government. But lawmakers are on a two-month recess that began about 2 weeks ago. Last month, civil society activists warned that failure to amend the laws before November would affect the formation of a unity government. Odwar says Kiir and Machar discussed the number of states, but only agreed to form another committee.
The two principals have agreed that, yes, we'll have a committee, and this committee will look more into the IBC report. And if we reach a consensus, that will be great. If we don't reach a consensus, then the principals will have to come together again and come up with a final statement or situation, position on the number of states.
Despite reaching no agreement on the unresolved issues, Information Minister Michael Makwe says Kiir and Machar are both confident a unity government will come together on time.
When I say in time, it means on the 12th of November.
It's not clear when Machar plans to return to Khartoum. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The body of former Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe returned home on Wednesday amid uncertainty over his burial place. Mugabe, Zimbabwe's founding president, passed away September 6 at age 95 in Singapore. Reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service is in Harare. He said the contradictions that characterized Mr. Mugabe's 37-year rule were on display on Wednesday as far less citizens turned out to welcome him.
the body of the former president of Zimbabwe, President Robert Mugabe, arrived in the capital, Harare, yesterday afternoon, and it was received at the airport by President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who hailed him as an iconic leader, and he also said the light which led to independence is no more, but his ideology will continue to guide this nation. Of course, the body was accompanied from Singapore by his wife, former First Lady Grace Mugabe.
I read an article, Blessing, describing the turnout during the time the body arrived in Harare. I think the article compares that to when Mugabe came to Harare following the Liberation War. Hundreds of people, if not thousands, that welcomed him, as opposed to the welcoming party on Wednesday.
The crowd was rather disappointing for a man of former President Mugabe's stature. But some people I talked to are saying that the government of President Emmerson Mnangagwa did not do enough to ask people to welcome the former president because of the animosity between the two. And even the T-shirts, actually, many people who turned up were wearing President Emmerson Mnangagwa's T-shirts, and there were very few who were wearing former President Robert Mugabe's T-shirts.
I understand that the Mugabe family refused to have the body spent a night at the army barracks, as is the protocol.
Indeed, all Zimbabweans who are declared national heroes are taken to one commando barracks to lie there for a night before the other funeral proceedings. But the Mugabe family, we understand, was not comfortable with that arrangement. So they requested that he be taken there for only 15 minutes before proceeding to his so-called Blue Roof House in Borodale. The family members I spoke to are saying that where they wanted to take him, that is one commando barracks, they are saying that it is one of the regiments that actually executed the coup that toppled him on the 15th of November 2017.
So, Blessing, can you look ahead for us, you know, in terms of when would the burial take place and where would it take place? Just the protocol ahead.
Many people thought that President Emmerson Mnangagwa was going to tell them where the former president is going to be buried. But he said again, like what his information minister said yesterday, that he will be buried on Sunday. They didn't state where he is going to be buried. But the government of President Mnangagwa wants him to be buried at the National Heroes Acre, which was built by the North Koreans. That is where the country's heroes are buried, in Harare. But of course, some family members want him still to be buried besides his mother, the late Bona Mugabe. They are saying that was his final wish.
Blessing, thank you very much again, and we shall check with you again on the following day.
Thank you so much, Jim.
That was reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service in the capital, Harare. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 12, and Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 18 minutes past the hour. The Kenyan government has launched a blood donation drive aimed at boosting blood banks in the country. Marie Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
The week-long drive will see prominent individuals participate in the blood donation exercise that is ongoing in Nairobi City Center. Speaking during the launch, Kenya's Health Cabinet Secretary Cecil Kariuki said that in every 10 minutes, at least 7 Kenyans need blood donation. Kariuki says there is a deficit of blood in most hospitals and that the drive is aimed at encouraging Kenyans to turn up and donate blood to save other Kenyans' lives.
Every 10 minutes, we have 7 Kenyans in need of blood to save their lives. It is not always that that blood is available. And that is why you are partnering with us, the 3 champions here today. You are speaking to the very need of Kenyan patients, that through the example that you have lived, it is possible for us to have blood available to all the patients who are in need. We have, as a country, a shortfall of blood stock that is required.
As per the World Health Organization standards, one unit of blood saves 3 lives. Ms. Kariuki says the health ministry is planning to have monthly blood donation drives in partnership with the county governments.
We have before us a bill which is in draft form and which is going through consultations and public participation to be able to locate matters of blood safety, blood donation, blood safety, blood transfusion. Starting here, be having monthly drives of blood donation, and we'll be doing this together with the county leadership. We will also be introducing a bill which will be looking at organ transplantation, which is envisaged in the Health Act of the year 2017.
The award-winning world's highest blood donor, Arjun Mainale, a Nepal native who has so far donated blood 171 times, said that he has reached millions of people globally with blood donation messages and through campaigns.
In Africa, every year, 0.6 million women, pregnant women, they die not getting the blood on time. That made me hurt. And so I realized I have to go there and ask the people to donate blood. I'm coming here donating blood for those who need. And I like to ask the youth, now your turn. Please donate blood. Donating blood is not harmful.
On the other hand, Kenya's very own highest blood donor, Alpha Kennedy Sanya, has urged Kenyans to turn up and donate blood to save lives.
As you know, in Kenya currently, cancer is a big, big, big issue. And without blood, it will be very, very difficult for us as Kenyans to save lives. May we as Kenyans always have time, once every 3 months, to make a donation of a pint of blood in Kenya so that we may save each and every one of us.
According to the Kenya National Blood Transfusion Services, the country needs 400,000 units of blood annually to fulfill various medical needs, yet it records a shortfall of 125,000 units per year. As per the World Health Organization, lack of enough blood is so common in most developing countries compared to high-income countries. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
A new report by the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says malnutrition levels among children under 5 years of age in South Sudan have increased to 16% this year, which is above the emergency threshold of 15%. UNICEF and two other UN agencies said in a joint press release on Wednesday that while food security has improved since June 2019, more than half of South Sudan's 6 million people do not know where their next meal will come from. Helen Sambu Rayan is a communication specialist for UNICEF in South Sudan. She says the slight improvement in the food security situation is due to humanitarian assistance.
There have been some slight improvements in the severity of the security situation, and this is mostly due to humanitarian assistance. But still, it's more than 50% of the country, they don't know where to get their next meal.
How serious is acute malnutrition among children in South Sudan?
Actually, the acute malnutrition levels among children have now exceeded emergency threshold. Are we talking about 1.3 million children acutely malnourished? And just to give you an idea about how much that is the number of people living in Copenhagen, the capital of Denmark. So we have seen a huge increase now in malnourished children. And of course, this is very much linked to the very serious security situation in South Sudan, but it's also linked to a lot of other things like access to clean water, access to sanitation. And I think it really says a lot, since these things are still not in place. It really says how complex malnutrition is, but also the fact that it takes much longer to rebuild the country compared to shattering it.
How is UNICEF helping in responding to the crisis?
So UNICEF is working throughout the country, supporting nutrition centers where we are doing greening of children, but also treating children for acute malnutrition. We're also treating and screening women, pregnant women, and also lactating women. But to be very honest, for every child we have treated, that is a failure, because we need a shift now, a paradigm shift from treating to preventing malnutrition. So we need to have more focus on preventing these children from becoming sick to begin with. And UNICEF is already doing that. So we are focusing on exclusive breastfeeding the first 6 months of a child's life, and then we are educating their caregivers on what is the appropriate nutrition for their children, and also using local produce when we're doing this education so they can actually access some of these nutritious food that we would recommend. But then we're also educating caregivers on the importance of clean water and also making sure that their hygiene is good in their home, but also personal hygiene. And when all of these things are coming together, we are in a much better position to make sure that children are not only surviving, but also thriving.
Helen Sambu-Rayen is a communication specialist for UNICEF in South Sudan. She spoke with Mavis Otiere from Juba. Doctors Without Borders added a fifth mental health facility in the West Point neighborhood of Liberia's capital, Monrovia, over the summer. Hassan Nasser, Doctors Without Borders psychiatrist in Liberia, spoke with Ricky Stryak about the mental health needs in the country and treatment hurdles.
Okay, there's only one Liberian psychiatrist in the country, and I'm not aware that there's any psychologist in the country. MSF has one psychiatrist, and I believe there's as well a Nigerian psychiatrist working here. So the total number is three psychiatrists in the whole country.
Every country, of course, people in the country have mental health issues, but in a country like Liberia, where you had a devastating civil war, and then most recently the Ebola crisis, which I'm sure there are extreme mental health needs.
Actually, it's very important. The needs are really high here, especially after you mentioned that they have 15 years civil war and the Ebola crisis as well, and the financial difficulties that they're having right now. So there are many risk factors that will make people develop either depression or anxiety or any other psychiatric disorder. Mostly, most of the cases that we are having are generalized anxiety, depression, psychosis, and epilepsy as well.
In a place like Liberia, where sometimes cultural norms, rather than encouraging people to talk about their worries, kind of encourage people to ignore their worries, how difficult is it not just to treat anxiety, but for people to even come to you guys with this problem and expressing what this problem is?
Most of the patients actually are coming for somatic complaints. They're complaining of pain, maybe headache or some neck pain. But during the interview, while you're asking the patient, you would realize that the pain is actually a part of a psychiatric disorder, and anxiety is the cause, and you have many associated symptoms like insomnia and depressed mood. And so many patients would come actually just complaining of physical problems. You would discover that there is a psychiatric problem, and it's related as well to the culture, because as you mentioned, that people are not encouraged to express a lot of their feelings, and even when they lose someone they love, they are encouraged more to overcome it.
Hassan Nasser is the Doctors Without Borders psychiatrist in Liberia. You are speaking with Ricky Stryak from Monrovia. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Sudan's transitional government on Wednesday signed an agreement with two rebel groups that could lead to a comprehensive peace by the end of the year. The rebels include the Sudan Revolutionary Front, which is an alliance of Darfur rebel groups, and Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, which is active in South Kordofan and Blue Nile. Yasser Aman, the deputy chair of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement SPLM North, says the agreement calls for implementing confidence-building measures by opening corridors for humanitarian purposes, cessation of hostilities, and release of all prisoners of war, as well as the dropping of all charges against rebel leaders. And that's it for this Thursday, September 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.